Hey everyone, welcome back to True Crime Cases. I'm your host, Allison Mendes, and today I'm going to tell you about the disappearance and murder of a six-year-old boy that would forever change the way missing children cases were handled. This is the story of Adam Walsh. Now, before we get into today's episode, I just wanted to do a little disclaimer. This episode does have some graphic content in it. It is a little boy. He's 6 years old. So I know a lot of people don't really do well with the cases that involve children. If that's you, you might want to skip this episode. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Adam's case. It's a very, very famous case. Still, some of you might not be super familiar with it. The manner in which his body is found, it's very graphic. So I just wanted to do a little disclaimer before we get into the episode. I don't want anyone hearing something that they weren't ready for or did not want to hear today. And let's get into it. On July 27th, 1981, six-year-old Adam Walsh, accompanied by his mom, Revae Walsh, head to the Hollywood Mall in Hollywood, Florida. Now, reports say that Revae was at Sears specifically for a lamp that was on sale. So while she headed to the lamp department, she let Adam stay at a kiosk in the toy department with a group of boys who were taking turns playing video games that had been on display. It's reported that Revae finished her shopping in the lamp department around 12:15 p.m., which was, I read other places that it was about a 10-minute time period where Revae was separated from Adam. She returns to the toy department in the video game kiosk where she had left Adam and discovers that Adam and the other boys who had been there had all disappeared. They were no longer in the area. Now, the store manager informs Revae that an argument had broken out between the boys over whose turn it was to play video games, and a young teenage security guard approached the boys, asked if their parents were with them in the store or around, and the older boys responded saying, no, our parents aren't in the store, and at that point, the security guard tells the boys that they need to leave the store because they're kind of causing a ruckus. Now later, John and Revae did say that they believe that Adam, because he was a shy boy and he was younger than the older boys that had been in the area, they think that he just didn't speak up when the security guard had asked the other boys if their parents were there, and he didn't let the security guard know that yes, his mom was in the store, which they think led the security guard to believe Adam was with the older boys. And because of this, he escorted Adam and the rest of the boys out of the store. And I read that he escorted them out of the west entrance of Sears, and Adam and his mother had entered through, I believe, the northern entrance of Sears, because it is a department store in a mall. And because of this, they think that he was at an entrance to the store and an exit that he wasn't familiar with. It wasn't the same way that he had come in, and that he probably was a little bit lost at this point. So after being informed of what happened by the store manager, Revae starts searching the department store. He's obviously not in the toy department where she had left him. While she's searching, she has the staff page Adam over the public address system. And in this time span, Revae actually runs into Adam's grandmother, Jean, who steps in and starts helping looking for Adam as well, as the staff of the store, I'm sure, is helping. And after about an hour and a half of searching and paging Adam with no luck finding him, Reve decides to call the Hollywood Police Department at 1:55 p.m. At this point, a massive search is underway for Adam. The police bring in helicopters, volunteers come in to help search the area around the mall. The mall itself is searched, but business hours come and go, and Adam is still nowhere to be found. Now, John and Reve don't waste any time whatsoever getting this out to the press. And Adam quickly becomes the poster child for missing children. This search gains nationwide publicity. It's a very, very famous case. And John and Reve are very active with the press, trying to get more and more publicity for their son so that they can find him. Now, 16 days later, on August 10th, two fishermen find a severed head floating in a canal off of the Florida Turnpike near Vero Beach, which is almost 130 miles from where Adam had gone missing. The next morning on August 11th, John and Reve had gone on national television hoping to, you know, do another interview about Adam, talking about how they were hoping, they still had hope they could find him alive, and they offered a $100,000 reward for his safe return. Now, that's the equivalent of about $284,663 today. Sadly, the remains that were found by those fishermen just a day before would soon be identified as Adam Walsh. And unfortunately, Adam Walsh's body would never be found. The coroner would rule that Adam had died from asphyxiation, and the state of his remains that they were found in suggested that he had died several days before his severed head had been found in the canal. This case was, as we're going to talk about a little bit later, in my opinion and in the Walsh's opinion, mishandled by police. And you're going to see what I'm talking about. But now I'm going to go over a man named Otis Toole, who would end up being named as the murderer of Adam Walsh. I'm going to go into his early life a little bit because it's a little fascinating. I'm going to do another trigger warning here. There's a lot of stuff that he said he went through, and it's very graphic and involves sexual abuse of a child. So I'm just going to give you guys a little bit of warning on that. Now, Otis Toole was born March 5th, 1947. He was born and raised in Jacksonville, Florida. And looking into this, I realized very quickly that his childhood was nowhere near normal. And all of this information should definitely be taken with a grain of salt, because a lot of this is a firsthand account of Toole. And he gives these statements, and I couldn't really find any corroboration from any secondhand witnesses or any other confirmation other than from Toole himself about his childhood. So just take that into account as we go over this. Now, according to Toole, his father was an abusive alcoholic who left early on in his life. His mother was also abusive, and I found conflicting reports. I found that his mother dressed him up in girls' clothing. I also found that it was his sister that did this. But either way, he did claim that he was dressed up as a girl and that they called him by the name Susan rather than his name. Toole claimed that he was a victim of sexual abuse and incest starting at a very young age at the hands of close family members, including his older sister and also some neighbors. He also claimed that his grandmother was a Satanist who exposed him to satanic rituals, including self-mutilation. He said she would have him rob graves for body parts to use in these satanic rituals, and that this all started at a very young age as well. Now, O'Toole claimed all of this family abuse began when he came out as homosexual to his family, and that he was dubbed the, quote, devil's child. Toole claims that he was forced to have sex with a friend of his father's when he was just 5 years old, and that he knew he was gay by the age of 10, and that he was in a sexual relationship with a neighbor boy by the age of 12. So this conflicts a little bit, that his abuse started when he came out as homosexual, because he's clearly stating that he was abused from the age of 5, and he's saying that he knew he was gay by the age of 10. So there wasn't much clarification on that, but I mean, Toole was classified as suffering from mild mental retardation. He had an IQ of 75. He was also diagnosed with epilepsy and often suffered from grand mal seizures. Later on during his trial, he would be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, which is the clinical diagnosis for what we call psychopaths, and that he was also classified as a paranoid schizophrenic as well. So he's got quite a few different mental health issues going on. He was also diagnosed as a pyromaniac as well. And you'll see that in a few minutes. Now, Toole was reported to have run away from home very frequently throughout his childhood. It happened often. He would sleep in abandoned homes in the neighborhood or throughout town. He was a serial arsonist from a young age and said he was sexually aroused by fire. Now, Toole drops out of high school his freshman year, drops out of school completely, and at this point, he says he begins frequenting gay bars in town, and he claims that he quickly became a sex worker and was obsessed, if not addicted to, gay pornography. Now, Toole claims he committed his first murder by the time he was 14 years old, when a traveling salesman propositioned him for sex, and Toole responded to this by running over the salesman with his own vehicle and killing him. I couldn't find anything to say this was cooperated or that they identified who this man was. I just know that it was cited in a lot of the articles that I read about him. And yeah, that's what I have about that. By the age of 17, Toole was arrested for loitering, and this would just be the beginning of a lot of run-ins with law enforcement from here on out. Now, getting into his crimes, there are several specific murders that he is a prime suspect for that he does not end up being convicted of. He later on will confess and recant those confessions to hundreds of murders. At one point, he claims, I think the number was, he was responsible for 1,008 murders. So just know that he is known to confess to a lot of crimes. He's also known to recant them. And he kind of becomes well known for being this criminal that police would kind of use to wrap up a case that they could not solve because they knew that they could get him to confess to something. So that is something that is known about him. And there's a lot of conspiracy around that and different cases that he might be involved with. But there's not a lot of information on what Toole gets up to between 1966 and 1973, but law enforcement believes that he began drifting around the southwestern United States and that he made a living as a sex worker and also by panhandling. Now, in 1976, Toole meets Henry Lee Lucas at a Jacksonville soup kitchen. They're both homeless at this point, I believe. And shortly after, the two do begin a sexual relationship with one another. And they will become accomplices in these murders later on. On January 4th of 1982, Tool barricades 65-year-old George Sonnenberg in a boarding house where he had been living in Jacksonville, and he set the house on fire. Now, George would die just a week later in the hospital from injuries that he sustained in this fire. And the next year, in 1983, Tool is arrested for an unrelated arson incident and later confesses that he and George had begun a sexual relationship, and that after an argument the two had, Tool had trapped George in the house and set it on fire. 2 months later, Tool's accomplice, Henry Lee Lucas, was arrested for unlawful possession of a firearm. And it's after this arrest that Lucas begins bragging about the, quote, murderous rampage that he and Tool had orchestrated together. And this really begins a long, long list of confessions to several different murders. And it's really unclear which ones he's actually responsible for, but I will go over the ones that he's actually convicted of. And both of these he actually recanted his confession for. But on April 28th of 1984, Tool is found guilty of first-degree murder for the murder of George Sonnenberg, the man that he trapped in the house and set on fire. And he is sentenced to death for that. And later that same year, Tool is found guilty of the murder of a 19-year-old woman and receives a second death sentence for that case. Now, I looked for the 19-year-old woman's name because he confessed to so many different killings. It was really unclear to me which one was her. I don't like leaving a victim unidentified, but I didn't want to get it wrong at the same time. But I know that it was a strangulation case of a 19-year-old woman in Tallahassee, Florida. Now, Tool would later appeal both of these cases, and both of them were commuted to life in prison instead of a death sentence. And after his incarceration for both of these murders, Tool pled guilty to four more Jacksonville murders in 1991, and he receives four more life sentences for these murders. Now, while Tool is imprisoned for the previous mentioned crimes he confessed to, he also confesses to the 1981 murder of Adam Walsh. Tool accompanies police to the bus, the exact bus bench, he said, outside of Sears, where he said he lured Adam into his vehicle by offering him candy and toys. This is going to get a little bit more graphic, but Tool said that he punched Adam in the face when Adam began crying, saying that he wanted to go home and he wanted his mom. Tool said he kept crying after he punched Adam in the face, and at this point he said he beats Adam until Adam is unconscious. Now, Tool says that he eventually pulls over in a rural area, and at this point he decapitates Adam with a machete. Tool says that he drove around with Adam's head for several days because he had, quote, forgotten about it. And when he rediscovered it somehow, he just tossed it into a nearby canal. Weeks later, police came forward saying that somehow they had misplaced Tool's impounded vehicle, which also had a machete in it. It's reported that the carpeting in the vehicle was also bloodstained. Due to this, the police were unable to test the vehicle. They couldn't test the blood, the machete. And because of this, Adam's case is kind of at a standstill, and they can't run any tests. They can't really proceed with the investigation into Tool for the murder of Adam. Now, Hollywood Police Chief Chadwick Wagner does come out and say that Tool had been the prime suspect all along, but admitted that the case against Tool was weak, maybe because they lost all of the physical evidence they might have had. He acknowledged that the police department had made several mistakes. He publicly apologized to the Walsh family on behalf of the police department, And he went on to explain that the lack of physical evidence or new evidence and the inability of Tool to defend himself because of his mental illness could give skeptics reasonable doubt if the case were taken to trial. And on September 15th of 1996, at the age of 49, Otis Tool died in Florida State Prison. He was never pressed. They never pressed charges against him for the murder of Adam Walsh. And he was obviously never convicted of it because of that. But according to his niece, he did confess to her on his deathbed again that he was responsible for the murder of Adam Walsh. And his niece came to John Walsh with this information, Adam's father. And John had been public about the fact that he did believe that Otis Tool was responsible for his son's death. Before this information, he already thought that he was because of the details that Otis was able to give around Adam's death. And it wouldn't be until December 16th of 2008 that Hollywood, Florida's chief of police, Chad Wagner, would announce alongside John Walsh, who had become a close friend of his at this point, that Adam's case would finally be closed. An external review of the case had been conducted, and both police and the family were satisfied with the conclusion that Otis Tool was responsible for the death of Adam Walsh. Now, I want to get into a little bit of the effect that Adam's case had on the country and on the way that we handle missing children's cases now. On October 10th of 1983, the television film called Adam, the premiered. The movie was based on Adam's kidnapping and murder. It attracted 38 million viewers on its first airing. And of its three broadcasts in each of its three broadcasts, sorry, in 1983, 1984, and 1985 were all followed by pictures and descriptions of other missing children. A hotline had been created for tips regarding the featured missing children in these at the end of these movies, and these pictures and hotlines were credited with finding a number of the missing children. In fact, 13 of the 55 children just shown in the first broadcast in 1983 were found. Now, in 1984, the United States Congress passed the Missing Children's Assistance Act, due in large part to the advocacy of the Walshes and also in part to the advocacy of other parents of missing children. This allowed the formation of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to be formed. Department stores now use a program in Adam's memory named after him. They call it Code Adam, and this is used whenever there is a lost child in a department store. The United States Congress passed the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act on July 25th of 2006, and on July 27th, President Bush signed this into law with John Walsh and Revae Walsh at the White House on the South Lawn for the signing of this bill. This bill institutes a national database of convicted child molesters and increased the penalties for sexual and violent offenders against children. It also created a RICO cause of action for child predators and those who conspire with them. The Adam Walsh Reauthorization Act of 2016 was incorporated into the Survivors Bill of Rights Act of 2016 to provide more budgetary allotments to continue programs that were passed in the 2006 Act. John Walsh went on to host the very popular show America's Most Wanted, which resulted in at least 17 of the most wanted fugitives that were featured on the show being captured and over 550 different cases being solved as a result of tips that came in from the show. In 2011, the show was canceled after over 1,000 episodes. However, this January, Fox announced that they will be bringing back the show with a new host, Elizabeth Vargas. And John Walsh has fully endorsed this. He has moved on to a new project. He is with working with Discovery on a show called In Pursuit with John Walsh. So check those out if you obviously love true crime because you're listening to this. And as usual, thank you all for listening. If you have time, please leave a review. It helps more than you know with a new podcast like this. It helps other people find us and us get, you know, an actual following going. And I would really, really appreciate it. Let me know what you guys think and what cases you're dying to hear about. You can find this podcast on Instagram at True Crime Cases Pod, on Twitter at TC Cases Pod, and on Facebook at True Crime Cases Podcast. Comment or message me and let me know what cases you guys want me to cover for future episodes. Sources for this episode can be found in the show notes below. Again, thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll be back next Tuesday with a brand new episode.